I'm Susan Yaffe with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, reaction to a rare address by Syria's president. Israel to build a Syrian border fence. Ramifications of the various uprisings throughout North Africa and the Arab world. And the number of Muslim Brotherhood members in Egypt's cabinet expands. It's all ahead. Looking tired but sounding confident, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad told a crowd of supporters at the Damascus Opera House Sunday that he is prepared to hold a dialogue with the opposition if it observes a ceasefire first. Opposition leaders dismissed the offer, saying it was devoid of substance. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Mr. Assad's supporters gave him a lengthy ovation following his first speech to the nation in more than 6 months. The Syrian president offered his vision for a dialogue with the opposition and his proposal for a possible solution to the 22-month-old conflict. According to that solution, the onus is on the opposition to stop armed operations first and for its foreign backers to stop supporting them as well. Mr. Assad says the funding and arming of rebel fighters must stop first, along with the halt of what he calls terrorist operations by those fighters, allowing refugees to return home in peace. At that point, he says, government forces will cease operations, keeping the right to return fire. Previous attempts at a ceasefire have collapsed over opposition insistence that both sides halt military operations simultaneously. UN observers withdrew from the country last spring after violence continued unabated, while a brief ceasefire after the Muslim holy month of Ramadan quickly collapsed. Mr. Assad's proposal for a dialogue with the opposition appears to come on his own terms as well, with him refusing to step down and the current government remaining in place while a national dialogue begins. He says the current government will begin holding intense discussions with all sectors of Syrian society in order to hold a national dialogue conference, including all parties interested in a solution to the crisis, both inside and outside Syria. In previous attempts at a national dialogue under the auspices of the Arab League, Mr. Assad tried to ignore or exclude various components of the opposition outside Syria. This time, however, he included opposition elements both inside and outside the country. The Syrian president, nevertheless, continued to refer to the armed opposition as terrorists and claimed there was no authentic revolution in his country. He says a revolution must have a leader and must have an intellectual foundation. In this case, he argues, there is no leader and no intellectual foundation because the supporters of the movement are a clique of criminals trying to harm the people. Mr. Assad also accused the West of fomenting the conflict in Syria in order to weaken his country and to attract elements of al-Qaeda there to be rid of them elsewhere. He went on to thank both Russia and China for supporting his government. Opposition leaders Walid Bunni and Samir Attaki both dismissed the speech, insisting that it contained nothing new. One Arab analyst told Al Arabiya TV that Mr. Assad was living in a dream world since the rebels are now at the gates of his palace. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Khalid Hoja is an opposition member of the Syrian National Coalition.
Nothing new in the dictator's speech. He was describing the uprising in Syria as if they are led by foreign countries. In this speech also he was denying the reality of the Syrian revolution. I was recently in a visit in the northern of Syria. The Syrian regime has lost the authority. Assad is denying the initiative of Mr. Akhdar Ibrahimi. He is refusing the political solution at the same time. So he's sending a message to international committee that he will not compromise with the international community to sit with the Syrian opposition on a table and discuss the situation. We can sit with the regime and discuss how can we manage the interim government, but not with Bashar Assad. Bashar Assad has to step down, and the Syrian regime can that time can sit with the opposition and discuss how can we manage the interim government.
Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu said Mr. Assad has not understood the demands of the people or his own responsibility for what has happened in Syria. He added Mr. Assad does not have a plan for the future and cannot make progress by denying the existence of the Syrian opposition. The United States says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's plan for a national reconciliation conference is detached from reality in his attempt to cling to power. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland said the Syrian leader has lost legitimacy. She repeated calls for him to step down, saying he's proposing dialogue while his government is deliberately stoking sectarian tensions and killing its own people. In Britain, during a Sunday morning television program, Prime Minister David Cameron said it is long past due for Mr. Assad to step down.
He has the most phenomenal amount of blood on his hands. We now see 60,000 people have been killed in Syria. I met some of the victims when I went to the refugee camp on the Jordanian border. And the stories they told me were completely shocking about how they'd been bombed and shot and in some cases even stabbed out of their homes, their villages and their towns. And this is a stain on the world's conscience.
In March of 2011, President Assad began suppressing what started as peaceful pro-democracy protests. Those demonstrations evolved into an armed rebellion aimed at ending the Assad family's four-decade authoritarian rule. Israel intends to reinforce its frontier with neighboring Syria amid growing concerns about the fallout from the Syrian civil war. Robert Berger has details from Jerusalem.
Israel plans to erect a new 5-meter-high fence on the Golan Heights, captured from Syria in 1967, and fortify it with trenches, barbed wire, and a road for army patrols. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told his cabinet Sunday that the Syrian army has moved away from the frontier and that what he called global jihad has moved in. That is a reference to militant Islamists from around the Middle East, including Al-Qaeda. Mr. Netanyahu said Israel would defend its border against infiltrations and terrorism. Israel has stayed out of the Syrian conflict, but recently a number of stray mortar rounds have landed inside Israeli-controlled territory on the Golan, prompting the army to fire back. The incidents raised concerns that the Syrian civil war could spill toward Israel. But Israel's biggest concern is that Syria's chemical weapons could fall into the hands of groups like Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah in Lebanon. Mr. Netanyahu said the Syrian regime is very unstable and the issue of its chemical weapons is a cause for concern. He said Israel is coordinating intelligence with the United States and other allies and is prepared for any scenario. He did not elaborate, but 2 months ago the Prime Minister told European ambassadors that Israel will do everything to ensure Syria's chemical weapons do not fall into the hands of terrorists, and that includes a military option. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Schomburg is a senior advisor on political reform in the Middle East and the wider Islamic world at the U.S. Institute of Peace. VOA's Carol Castiel on Press Conference USA asked about the ramifications of the various uprisings throughout North Africa and the Arab world.
Let's start with a broader question about the Arab Spring, its trajectory. It's been about 2 years since Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in Tunisia and sort of sparked what we call the Arab Awakening. What are your thoughts about how these events have played out over the last several years throughout North Africa and the Middle East, and where are we today, basically?
Your question is interesting because in the question you referred to the Arab Awakening, you referred to the Arab Spring, and there's a third terminology often used, and that is the Arab Uprisings, which I prefer, if only because what we had in the Arab world and what we have seen over the last 2 years are a series of political and economic and social uprisings by diverse groups, not always with the same agendas. I see a lot of the instability resulting from the fact that, first of all, old regimes want to hang on to power as long as they possibly can, and as we see in Syria, will use force to do so. On the other hand, I see oppositions which are far from united in their ultimate strategic objective, and I see particularly the struggles over identity issues, particularly but not exclusively between Islamists and secularists, as really undermining the capacity to create the kinds of consensus for peaceful change we might otherwise have. So we have uprisings. Whether they lead to stable democracies is a different question.
In terms of this identity question, I'd like you to elaborate a bit about that, since you just edited a volume about this very subject, conflict, identity, and reform in the Muslim world. What are the challenges that this concept poses for the United States and for the rest of the world?
Well, that's a good question. In most transitions, speaking from the vantage point of a scholar and not in any way representing the particular views of the United States Institute of Peace, but from the vantage point of a scholar, I would suggest that democratic transitions require some sort of negotiated outcome. Negotiated outcomes between two sets of groups. First of all, regimes and oppositions, if at all possible. And within oppositions themselves over what they ultimately want in confronting regimes. And where there is a struggle over what it means to be Egyptian, what it means to be Syrian, what it means to be Libyan, what the role is and relationship between mosque and state, for example, it's really hard to have a negotiation over such intangible questions. And I think particularly for minority groups, secularists, who are in many respects a minority in the Arab states, and for, let's just say, for example, in Syria, the Alawites, they fear democracy because democracy always carries the potential that the opposition will impose its point of view on the minority. And therefore, we see a great deal of fear generated by the prospects for democracy. We didn't see that in the beginning in Egypt because secularists took the lead. But when it became clear that the Islamists were the first to benefit from this transition, secularists became very fearful of the outcome. And in my own personal point of view, President Morsi has done very little to address these fears. So democratization generates fears among different identity groups because it allows one group to invoke the ballot to impose its agenda on the others. And where that is a possible outcome, democracy can be a prescription for conflict.
Daniel Brumberg, Senior Advisor, Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Egypt's Islamist President Mohamed Morsi has expanded the number of Muslim Brotherhood ministers in his cabinet as part of a reshuffle aimed at improving the government's handling of an economic crisis. 10 Egyptian ministers were sworn in on Sunday, 3 of them members of Mr. Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood movement. A Brotherhood spokesman said the reshuffle increases the number of Brotherhood cabinet ministers from 5 to 8. Eric Traeger is a Next Generation Fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We asked for his reaction to the changes in Egypt.
This has to be seen as part of the long-term plan of the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, you can't just look at it in terms of how many has he appointed, because the truth is 3 out of 10 being from the Muslim Brotherhood is not a big number. We have to look at it is as the Muslim Brotherhood gradually expanding its control over the cabinet, going from 5 to 8, and presumably to many more ministers in the not-too-distant future. Now, the most interesting appointment, in my view, was Muhammad Ali Bishr, who was appointed Minister of Local Development, I believe, And Muhammad Ali Bishr is a member of the Muslim Brotherhood's guidance office. That's their senior executive body. And what we're seeing is, and we've frankly seen this in the appointment of governors, in the appointment of presidential advisors, in of course members of the Muslim Brotherhood's party, the Muslim Brotherhood is gradually distributing its very top leaders across the new bodies of government that it now controls. And I think we're also going to see more of that in the months and perhaps years to come.
What will this mean for the country?
What it means is that the Muslim Brotherhood, a very secretive, tight-knit organization, is going to try to centralize its control over these bodies of government that it's increasingly influencing. So decision-making will not be made, for example, in the Ministry of Local Planning. It's going to be made in the Guidance Office, which is, again, the Brotherhood's senior executive body. And that just, gets to the kind of broader point that Egypt is not really moving in a democratic direction. Yes, the Muslim Brotherhood won elections, but it's very quickly trying to shift decision-making away from official governmental channels and towards its own internal institutions.
And what are their own policies that would be influencing the country?
Well, one of the things they're going to try to do, of course, and this has been their long-term plan, is Islamize Egyptian society. And they're going to do that through a number of ways, one of which is, of course, through the education system. Another is through the banking system. It's worth noting that although they didn't name a Muslim brother to the finance ministry, the new finance minister is a professor who's been advocating using sukuk, which are Islamic loans, to finance the government. So you're going to see more of this kind of domestic Islamization. I think you're also going to see, maybe in a couple of years, a pursuit of the Brotherhood's long-term foreign policy agenda. Now, that's very much been put on hold because the Brotherhood is still focused domestically, but the more that the Brotherhood consolidates power, the more likely it is to continue its pursuit of its very long-term agenda, which is not only Islamizing Egypt, but creating what it calls an Islamic League of Nations.
Eric Traeger, a Next Generation Fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Mr. Morsi promised a cabinet reshuffle last month as part of a plan to restore confidence in the economy, which has seen a slump in foreign tourism and investment due to political instability since the 2011 ouster of longtime President Hosni Mubarak in a popular uprising. Egypt also has been suffering a currency crisis that has seen the Egyptian pound weaken to eight-year lows against the dollar. Egypt's central bank has spent billions of dollars to support the value of the pound since 2011, leaving its foreign reserves at what it calls a critical level. In a report Sunday, the central bank said Egypt's foreign reserves were just above $15 billion in December, a slight decline from the previous month. Mr. Morsi also is under pressure to raise taxes and introduce other austerity measures in exchange for a $4.8 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund. Iranian lawmakers have called for a special investigation into the death of a dissident blogger detained by the country's cyber police last year. In a report published Sunday, Iran's Parliamentary Committee on National Security and Foreign Policy said a new investigation is needed because of signs that Sattar Bahashti died of shock and other wounds inflicted by cyber police interrogators. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.